WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cowain. Back in the early 70s, when the Cold War was very much alive, Hedrick Smith was in the thick of the conflict, reporting from the Soviet Union for the New York Times. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage and wrote the best-selling book, The Russians. 2 years ago, Smith went back to a changed Soviet Union to document how Gorbachev's reforms were affecting people's lives. He took a film crew and hosted a four-part series on Frontline called Inside Gorbachev's USSR. Last month, Smith returned to Russia and looked up the same people he had filmed 2 years ago to see how their lives had changed amidst the political and economic upheavals. His new documentary, After Gorbachev's USSR, will be broadcast on the PBS series Frontline this Tuesday. Smith found that the breakup of the Republic and Yeltsin's lifting of price controls has created shortages and uncertainty. I asked him how people were coping.
With enormous difficulty, with a lot of complaining, and just simply enduring a battle for survival. At the personal level, I mean, I found people who'd literally waited in line 4 hours to buy a couple of loaves of bread. At the industrial level, I found major industrial companies where the managers said they were cut off by some of their suppliers because of the breakup of the Soviet Union, a Russian enterprise with 29 Ukrainian suppliers getting nothing from the Ukraine because of the fight between Boris Yeltsin, the president of Russia, and Leonid Kravchuk, the president of Ukraine. So disruption almost everywhere, but a few signs here and there of things developing. The first commodity exchanges, actually the ticker tape showing in one stock exchange, commodity exchange, unusual. Big change from a couple of years ago. Private farmers beginning to appear, having their own herds of livestock. So some counter trends, but the overwhelming impression is one of enormous difficulty. As Yeltsin said to the people when he started this period of reform, these will be the hardest months since Russia emerged from World War II. And a lot of Russians find it that way.
Who calls themselves then communists in Russia today?
Almost nobody does. Everybody wants to be, that's not true, everybody, but the great majority of people want to be thought of as new Russians, as new thinkers, as reformers. I mean, people who have no idea what the market economy is like and who abhor many of its characteristics and fear the uncertainties involved in trusting the law of supply and demand will nonetheless say they're for a market. Almost everybody says they're for a democracy. There are more and more people, however, who are saying this winter that democracy and market economics bring chaos, bring high prices, bring poverty, and are going to bring unemployment and so forth. Therefore, we need to turn back towards firm rule, towards a tough boss at the top, towards the kind of firm hand that Russians are used to. Very few of them will say what we need is restoration of communism. But what they do say is we need the strong central hand at the top, and that's almost synonymous with communism to a lot of them.
You mentioned Russian President Boris Yeltsin's lifting of price controls. Can you tell us what then the sort of personal effect that that is having on people's lives? And I guess we can focus in the beginning on people living in cities like Moscow.
Well, it doesn't matter whether you're in Moscow or in provincial cities like Ivanovo or Yaroslavl or Novgorod, in central Russia or in western Russia. What happened was literally overnight, the price of bread tripled. The price of milk in Yaroslavl, where I went up from 60 kopecks to 6 rubles, 80 kopecks to 6 rubles 40 overnight. Never mind what the exchange rate is. Overnight, it went up eightfold. So it's an enormous jolt to people. The expectation of Yeltsin and company is that a lot of people will not pay those prices and that the producers, in order to market their goods, are gradually going to have to lower the prices. But what they're up against is the old wholesale cartels that existed in the Soviet system. There was, in Moscow, there was a central milk distribution agency. There's a central bakery. There's a central dairy products wholesale trading agency. And it's a monopoly. And even though you've gotten rid of the price controls, that monopoly or those monopolies out in the provinces can decide what to charge. And in a way, you don't have a free market system. So what Yeltsin is hoping to do is to jar those people so hard that they're going to have to figure out a better market strategy, lower the prices, and gradually things will get more normalized. But it's a very painful process to go through.
Well, are you then suggesting that people are starving? Is malnutrition a real threat to the Russian people?
I don't think people are starving. We haven't seen any evidence of death by famine, but there's no question that the older people who are living on fixed pensions, who have no outside earning power, are really in very bad shape. The outside food aid that is coming in primarily from Western Europe, but also to some degree from the United States, is very important to keep these people going. Many of them are showing up in the new Russian equivalent of soup kitchens, depending to some degree on charity to keep them going. And I think Yeltsin is under a great deal of pressure to increase their pensions. Outright starvation, not yet, but pretty different. These people are living on bread and very watery soup, very meager rations, just as they lived after World War II.
I'm speaking with Hedrick Smith, and he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. And just recently, he visited the Soviet Union and looking at the reform of that country. And his documentary will appear on this week's Frontline, which is a PBS documentary series. You visited in the countryside and went to visit a number of farmers. And it appears, certainly the way you present it in your documentary, that there's just about a war going on between state-owned farms and private farmers.
Well, there is, except that it's a very unequal war. The state farmers have all the resources. They have the machinery of the state behind them. They have the workers, and they have a lien on the state credit system. So it's very difficult for private farmers. There are probably in Russia only about 40,000 private farmers all told, and there's several million people working on the state and collective farms. So it's an uneven struggle. What's going on is that there are a few hardy souls who say, I can do better on my own. I want to raise my own cattle or sheep or pigs or grain or whatever it is, and they try to go out on their own. They then have an enormous problem getting tractors, equipment, fertilizer, marketing their products once they get done. The present situation of shortages helps them a bit. I did meet one farmer, Alexander Yozhikov, whom you'll see, and he has just made, just before my arrival, a big deal with a local factory to sell meat and milk to that factory. So he is helped by that. On the other hand, he's desperate for feed grain to keep his cows producing milk during the wintertime, and the whole state distribution system is tilted towards the state farms, and he can't get a hold of it. I'm there on his farm with a state farmer who's got lots of grain. He wants to buy some grain from the state farmer, and the state farmer doesn't want to help him. So there is a great sense of rivalry. The state farm director is afraid that if Yozhikov, the private farmer, succeeds, that many of his own farm workers will decide to go the same way, and he will lose his state farm, his power, his prestige, his privileges, his job. So he's fighting it.
You say there are just about 40,000 private farmers. What do you think they have in common, or what do you think it is that makes them so determined to be private farmers in a system that's really, even at this point, working against them?
I don't know. Guts. It's very striking. These are very unusual people. I asked Yozhikov what it took. He said working about 15 or 16 hours a day and self-confidence. And I said, so where did you get the self-confidence? He said, Neftchanikam Bill. I was an oil driller up in the north. He said, do you know what it takes to drill oil in Siberia? He said, that's what it takes. And so, I mean, I think it does take that kind of determination because you have to buck not only the elements and all the problems that farmers all over the world face, but you have to fight a system which is still in the hands of people that prefer a socialist state-oriented system.
Well, do they call themselves capitalists? Is that literally how they think it, or is it just that this is a matter of their own survival?
Well, there's a different term in Russia. It's the term is chasniki, which means kind of privatizers. It's the equivalent of capitalists. They don't use the word capitalist, but no, they think of themselves as individual entrepreneurs, as do the people who are operating in the private sector. And there are about 7 million people in the small trade, small business, medium-sized business, private sector of the Russian economy now. So it's growing. But this is still a very small minority of the people.
Is capitalism considered an American word?
Sometimes it's certainly a Western word, and to some people it's good, and to an awful lot of people it's still a bad word. I mean, the market is a good word. Market means sort of more goods, a little bit more competition, and somehow it's not connected with any of the downside, with unemployment, with businesses failing, or, you know, with high prices or anything like that. Capitalism is still, in a lot of Russians' minds, a word that implies speculation and somehow creaming an either illegal or improper profit off goods, exploiting other people, either your workers or the customers. So it still isn't yet a good word. People use other words even when they're in favor of moving in that direction.
I'm speaking with Hedrick Smith, and he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, television documentary correspondent, and also the author of a number of books about the Russians. And his latest book, The New Russians, is just now out in paperback. He just returned from Russia, where he was working on a documentary for Frontline. It will air this week on Frontline series, and it's called After Gorbachev's USSR. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with journalist Hedrick Smith, and we're talking about Russia. He just returned from a visit there and a visit for a documentary, which will appear on the Frontline series this week. One of the workers that you spoke to said, "We used to work for the party government," and he named several other sort of institutions. But "we don't know who we're working for now." Is that part of the problem, you think, is that it's sort of the Russian people just not having a sense of who they're working for and what that all means?
The really biggest difficulty in perestroika, in restructuring that society, is not the building of new institutions. It is changing people's mindsets. It's their psychology. Russians are historically used to having a strong central government, focusing on the leadership, getting orders from above, and having a sense that they work for, if not the state under the communist system, then Russia under the old czarist system. And the czar and the governor and the whole structure of the Russian government before the communist system was very strong in their minds. Now, as they said, and as you quoted, they're suddenly given freedom. Yeltsin has gone further than Gorbachev in trying to break up the centralized power, to free things up, to have more pluralism, more competition. And these people are baffled by it all. As you said, they say, "Who are we working for now?" And you answer, "We're supposed to be working for yourselves." And their answer is, "Well, how does that work? I mean, somebody's got to give the orders here. Somebody's got to run the factory." And they haven't gotten to the point yet of having stockholders. But if they do, and you talk to them about that, they say, "Who are the stockholders?" It's such a foreign notion, the whole way that capitalism operates, that it's going to take quite a while for people's minds to change so that they can understand it, first of all, but then trust it.
Well, it's also a system, you say, that's not working yet. So even then, to work within this system, it seems to me, at least certainly the way you painted in your documentary, they're not getting any returns for it.
That's right. The Russian leadership didn't do what the Chinese leadership did back over a decade ago, which was to give the people in the countryside more and more land they could work for themselves and an incentive of money to make more and grow more and then send more of their food to the cities. What happened in a very simple way for the Chinese peasantry and then for the city dwellers is they could understand that if you change to a slightly freer economic system, there would be benefits for everybody. The Chinese leadership built a constituency for that kind of economic reform. Gorbachev didn't do that. Now Yeltsin has come along and he's in an absolute crisis situation and he's got to change things. He doesn't have the time to do this. I think this will happen. I think in 2 or 3 years, you're going to see the same kind of thing happening in the countryside in Russia as you saw in China. But we're now at the very, very early stages of it, and Russians can't see results. So naturally, they're skeptical and afraid.
Well, I wonder, too, how just the issue of scarcity plays into people's mindset. It's very difficult to think either long term or to think beyond your own specific needs if you feel like there isn't enough to go around.
Absolutely. An awful lot of people who are for reform in principle have given up on it this winter simply in the struggle for survival. One of the striking things that I found was the generational differences. If you talk to older people, people over 60, over 55, they were angry, they felt abandoned, They felt as though not only were they suffering from low pensions and shortages, but that their whole lives had been called into question. The new leadership, the new philosophy, the new thinking, the new Russians were telling them, look, everything you did was sort of in vain and stupid, and you were a tool of Stalin and Brezhnev and Khrushchev and company. And they are fed up and discouraged. If you go to the other end, you go to people under 35, they have some hope for the future. They say, all right, it's worth making some sacrifices now to make things better. You find more people in that age group in the private sector attempting new things, willing to experiment, not so locked into the old system. And then you find, you know, the great bulk of the population between 35 and 60 kind of swinging with the winds. If things are working, well, they're for it. If things aren't working, then they're against it. And right now, they're against reform. They've given up because the practical results are so difficult for them personally.
Would you say, then, this winter was the real test for the Russian people and the Russian government?
I think this winter and next winter. If next winter is, you know, they're getting close to finishing this winter. And Russian psychological moods do change with the seasons. When the weather gets warmer, you can go outside, you start your spring planning, that kind of stuff. There is a kind of a lifting of the spirits over there. So by mid-April, they'll be feeling better. But if next winter is like this winter, I'm not sure that the experiment will survive at least that winter. There'll be a swing back to the right. This is a time of testing right now for them and, for that matter, for the West and whether or not we're going to help.
What are some of the bright signs you see in Russia?
Well, what struck me and what was interesting for me personally was to go back and see old friends whom I knew and to follow the timelines of their personal lives and to see what had happened. Because when you look at the situation in general, it's pretty dark. I mean, you see the hunger, you see the high prices, you see the demonstrations of people are unhappy. But when you go into people's lives and you see four women, for example, in one city where they'd had a hunger strike 2.5 years ago in order to try to reopen the church and that Stalin had closed in their city and there was only one functioning church in their city, you go back to that city, as I did, and you find that there are now four functioning churches. The church where there was a hunger strike, there are 1,500 people attending Mass, and the women aren't even there because they've gone on and they've opened up two more churches. That's a big change. When you go to a city like Novgorod, where I met a man named Mark Masarsky, who was a small entrepreneur when I met him 2.5, 3 years ago, he'd taken an old prison, converted it into a brick factory. I go back this time, he's got a small commercial empire. You know, he's got joint ventures with Austrians and Swiss and Yugoslavs. He's a partner in a bank. He's got several other enterprises. He's got a scheme now to go mine gold and to help the country as well as helping himself. I mean, big change in his life. You go into the countryside 2.5, 3 years ago, you practically couldn't find any private farmers. Now you find a few, not many, but you find some, and they're surviving somehow. Even when you go to a huge factory like Uralmash, in what used to be called Sverdlovsk, now called Yekaterinburg, a throwback to the old Russian past, you find the directors there complaining terribly about all the disruptions of the breakup of the Soviet Union, of not getting supplies, of having to barter and everything. But you find them grudgingly readjusting to the new economic situation, making changes. There are new commodity exchanges where they can buy some of their supplies. So there are these changes, but they're rather subtle. They haven't built a momentum yet. But there are things that are going on that show positive trends, positive undercurrents beneath this kind of surface whipping up of the waves of suffering this winter over the economic situation.
What do you think the United States should do to help the Russian people?
Well, I think there are probably two things, and we've really focused only on one of them. I think the first thing that needs to be done by the West as a whole, and by the way, the Europeans are much more prepared to do this than we are. We're the ones who are dragging our feet, so it's not as if we're way out front. First thing we got to do is help them stabilize the value of their currency. One of the reasons why there's so much economic uncertainty, why goods aren't coming to the market, why people aren't doing business, is they don't know what the money is worth. And an economic, international economic stabilization fund is enormously important. But much more important than that over the long run is what I would call human aid, talent aid, a large Peace Corps, an executive service corps, a pensioners corps, lots of Americans going to Russia or Ukraine or other places to help teach them how to run city government, how to run their businesses, how to set up businesses, and vice versa. A lot of those people coming over here. The way you build the infrastructure of democracy in a market economy is basically by the transfer of human knowledge. Now, in some cases, they've got, for example, very talented, well-organized people in the old military-industrial complex. We need to help channel that into peaceful production before it comes back to haunt us again.
Do you think that the old system, the old communist system, has really collapsed? And do you think that the coup of August was really the last gasp of that old system?
Well, I think it was the last gap of the old system in the sense of a power struggle to try to restore the old system. But your other question about whether or not the old system has collapsed is a very good one. What I wrote in The New Russians was that it was decapitated. The old system was decapitated. Its head was cut off by the failure of the coup. The command center in Moscow was cut. But that the body, the arms, the legs, all the tentacles of the old system remain out in the countryside and even in the city of Moscow, particularly in the economy. I think this is what Yeltsin is trying to break up. This is something I think that is very difficult for outsiders to understand. We tend to look at Russian politics, Soviet politics, in black or white, either or. Either the reformers are in power or the old guard is in power. But the situation's much more mixed than that. Yeltsin and the reformers are in power at the center. But in fact, there are a lot of the old people who are still sitting there in their old jobs all over the country, and they are great obstacles to progress. That's the people who the private farmers, the private entrepreneurs, the new younger people are fighting against. The new Russians are still fighting against the old Russians who are still there.
There was one farmer that you met with, and he owned one of the big state-supported farms. And one of the things you did was to take a bath together or to jump into a pool together.
Yeah.
That's called a banya?
A banya. It's the old Russian banya. It's a whole ritual. What you do is you get in the equivalent, Russian equivalent of a sauna, except they love to throw either water or beer on the rocks, and then they get the branches of birch leaves and they beat each other in order to bring your blood to the surface. They think it purifies you, and then you go plunge into the cold water in the pool, or you take a cold shower, and then get back out and do it again. And that's typical in that part of the world. Finns do it, Swedes do it, but the Russians do it in a kind of more earthy way. And that's just part of mixing in and getting into their culture. It's a lot of fun.
Well, it was great to see two men with towels sort of talking about the world.
I guess that's what the Romans used to do.
Well, Hedrick Smith, thank you so much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
It was my pleasure.
Hedrick Smith is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He recently visited Russia to make a documentary for the PBS Frontline series. The documentary is called After Gorbachev's USSR, and it airs this Tuesday. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.